Welcome to the HR Power Hour, presented by Career Management Associates. I'm David Chulo. It's about all things in the human resource world. We're going to bring in local, regional, and national guests, and we're going to talk about a variety of topics and explain why human resource management is critical to your business success so that you can make decisions to keep and retain great talent.
Welcome to the HR Power Hour, presented by CMAcareer.com and Verrill-Law.com. I'm Tawny Alvarez, your host from Verrill, and today our guest is Rob Brooks, attorney and labor and employment law partner at Verrill. And today we're discussing the Great Resignation and restrictive covenants. Specifically, we're going to spend the day talking about steps your company can take to protect competitive data at a time when employees are transitioning in and out of companies regularly. Welcome, Rob, and thank you so much for joining us.
Hi, Tawny. Great to be here. Thanks for inviting me.
Well, I am really excited for today's show, and I really think it's going to add a lot of value to our listeners because you and I both, I feel like, are dealing with a lot of questions and situations where we have employees who are leaving an employer's employment, and they may be going on to competitors, or they may be leaving the industry in general. But we know that when an employee walks out the door, there is a chance that important competitive data is going to leave with them. So I think this is going to be an episode that a lot of employers can relate to, and with hope that they're going to be able to look at the documentation that they have in place currently and hopefully create some changes after listening to some of the advice that you have. I know, however, you've been a guest on the show before, but for our new listeners, can you share a little bit about yourself and the work that you do at Verrill?
Sure. So I am the chair of the firm's labor and employment department, of which you are vice chair. And I have been practicing law at Verrill for 30 years now, and I focus on labor and employment. One of the things that I have done over my time at Verrill is to advise clients on how to protect confidential company information. And this includes drafting agreements that employees would sign to protect that information, drafting policies that would govern the same topic. And then when an employee promises to break that commitment to protect information, then I've helped clients take action to stop the damage, to whether it's sending letters to employees to tell them to stop or suing them. And so that those sorts of cases have compromised a lot of the work that I've done over the last couple decades.
One of the things I really enjoy about our practice, Rob, because you and I do have this element of our practice in common, is that we both get to advise on policy creation and drafting of contracts. And then we also litigate it so that we are able to see the effect that different terms and conditions have when we get into a courtroom or when we are trying to defend the viability of provisions that we may have required employees to enter into. And I'm excited because during the course of this episode, I do want to spend some time talking about what litigation regarding restrictive covenants looks like. But before we get into that, I think that there's probably some listeners who are saying, when you say restrictive covenants, what are you talking about, Tawny? So for listeners who may not be aware, what does the general term restrictive covenants encompass?
Sure. Well, the name certainly gives you some clues. A covenant is really just another word for promise. And restrictive is something that limits somebody's actions. So in the context of employment and restrictive covenants, we're talking about an obligation or a promise on an employee that limits the conduct of that employee either during or more often after employment. So these sorts of restrictions include what kind of information the employee can use outside of work. And we typically cover those in what's called a confidentiality agreement or non-disclosure agreement. These sorts of restrictions can also include what the employee can do outside of work, like moonlighting. Can they work in a kind of business that might conflict with the employer's business interests? These restrictions can also include what the employee can do after work in terms of soliciting. When I say after work, after they've left the employment, in terms of soliciting business from, let's say, the employee, the employer's customers or vendors or other business partners. We call those, that's a non-solicitation agreement. And these kinds of agreements can also limit what the employee can do after the employment ends in terms of who they work for. And that's what we call a non-competition agreement.
So I think today, if we focus in on three different types, so confidentiality obligations, I'd like to talk about. I'd like to talk about non-solicitation, either provisions or agreements. And then the one that we hear most often, a non-compete agreement or a provision. Now, I'm sure there's a lot of listeners who are saying, nope, I've got this all under control. No need to listen any further. In my employee handbook, I have a confidentiality provision, and I require my employees to sign the employee handbook saying that they've received it. Is that sufficient? Is having a clause within your employee handbook, does that constitute a restrictive covenant for purposes of protecting a company's confidential data?
Well, it's depending on the circumstances, it may be okay if you're willing to rely on the sort of the goodness of people to follow the employer's handbook, which can be an implied condition of employment. But when it comes to enforcing that commitment, if you're just got a handbook, I think the employer will have a very difficult time convincing a court that this handbook provision, which most handbooks say is not a contract, by the way, that this non-contractual statement by the employer it will necessarily bind the employee's conduct after they leave work. So, which isn't to say that the handbook is not an important part of protecting your trade secrets, but generally speaking, if the employer is really serious about protecting its trade secrets and other confidential information, or protecting its goodwill in terms of its customers and business partners or client information, then it would be our recommendation as lawyers to go beyond just the handbook and take additional measures to protect that information.
You're listening to the HR Power Hour radio show. I'm your host, Tani Alvarez, and today our guest is Rob Brooks, attorney and labor and employment law partner at Verrill. And today we're discussing the great resignation and restrictive covenants. And we now know, we know what restrictive covenants are, and we have an understanding as to the fact that we need an agreement. So having a policy may be nice, and it may dissuade individuals from doing behaviors that you want them to stay away from. But more specifically, having some form of a contract or agreement is important. And I'd like to start kind of talking really more in depth, Rob, about confidentiality provisions. Is this something that every single company should have? Is require all new employees who come into the organization to sign a confidentiality agreement? Or should it be more limited either to higher level individuals or individuals who may have access to more specific information?
I think most employers should give some thought to how they want to protect their trade secrets, unless you're one of those rare employers who doesn't have any trade secrets. But for those employers who have information that they want to keep confidential and not get out there, whether to their competitors or to the public, then they ought to have some process in place. And so this isn't to say that every employee has to sign a formal agreement, but I think to the extent you have employees who have access to confidential company information, that some serious thought should be given to making an employee sign at least a simple statement, and we can talk about what this would include, but some sort of acknowledgement and agreement that the information they learn in the course of working for the company, and it could be something as simple as just customer lists, customer identity, private information of customers, and that this information will not be used by the employee outside of work, and they agree to keep it confidential for as long as that information remains secret. So, you know, does that go down to the lowest level employee in a company? It could. So, for instance, let's say you've got a house cleaning company and your employees go off into your customers' homes where they would have the ability to see all kinds of private information in the course of doing their work, or you presumably would want those employees not to be talking about what they see in your customers' houses. Or if you have an employee who is works at a cash register and has access to confidential credit card information, for instance, you know, that information should be kept secret. So I think most employers could benefit from having an employee, almost all employees, with access to information that is sensitive and private, acknowledge in writing that they're going to keep that secret.
I think you make some really, you know, very, very good points there. And I loved how you've evolved confidential information to include not just the information that a company has, so client information, data, maybe business plans, marketing strategies, the stuff that's held by the employer themselves, but then also when we're talking about third-party information, your example concerning a house cleaner who goes into someone else's home, we know that the data or information that may be sitting in that home, that's not the company's confidential data, but the company has had access to it as a result of the interaction with that client. So are you saying that that data can then be protected, that an organization can protect a third party's data, even though they might not have control over all aspects of that data?
It sure can. And indeed, it may not qualify as the employer's trade secret, but it certainly is subject to protection by a non-disclosure agreement as being sensitive and private, and important that the employer, the business, keep it private and confidential. And so you as the employer would have a large incentive to take measures to protect this, you know, your customer's information, for no other reason, at least, than that if this information gets out because of your failure to take steps with your employees to keep this information confidential, your customers can sue you for negligence, you know, that the employer did not take adequate steps to protect your customer's information. So you might not only just lose the customer or client, you would be exposed to damages if you, the employer, did not take adequate steps to prevent your employees from misusing your customers or clients' confidential information.
Now, you just used a term, you said a non-disclosure provision. Now, is a non-disclosure provision the same as a confidentiality provision? Are they just different terms for a very similar either provision or agreement?
I think most people, including me, use those terms interchangeably. So a non-disclosure agreement applies to confidential information, generally speaking, and a confidentiality agreement essentially covers the same sorts of information.
And sometimes an employer is going to call this an NDA as well, correct? So all three of those terms are all going to really be talking about the protection of confidential documents, information, lists, all of those things, right?
That's right. NDA rolls off the tongue a little more easily than confidentiality. So I think NDA is something that is used quite frequently.
I would definitely agree with that. Now, one, you know, final question I have about confidentiality agreements. Can you require that an employee keep confidential or not share with outside sources confidential information that he, she, or they have created in the course of their work? So let's say that the employee creates either a document or a concept or an idea that becomes confidential to the employer. Can you require that that no longer is shared outside of the organization in the future?
You sure can, but and it's your question is an excellent one. With respect to ideas or inventions that the employee comes up with during employment, it's important for the employer to lay that out at the outset of the employment. So so in order to protect the employer's ability to claim ownership of that idea or invention, it's useful and almost really essential to have an agreement that says you, the employer, have ownership of this, of these inventions or these ideas. And so it's a little different brand of a restrictive covenant. But typically it's rolled into an NDA or confidentiality agreement.
Thanks, Rob. That is really helpful to understand. We're going to take a quick break. You're listening to the HR Power Hour on News Talk WLOB 100.5 FM and WLOBradio.com. We'll be right back.
Founded in 1958, Jackson Lewis is a national law firm with a local presence. The firm's 765 attorneys practicing in 54 locations throughout the U.S. and Puerto Rico provide a wide range of resources to address every aspect of the employer-employee relationship. HR professionals, business and in-house counsels, and C-suite professionals count on Jackson Lewis as it has one of the most active employee litigation practices in the United States. Contact them today at jacksonlewis.com. That's jacksonlewis.com.
Being a father is an honor, a challenge, a duty, a celebration, and a testimony. I want to be legendary for you because I found everything to live for.
That's dedication. Visit fatherhood.gov to hear more. Brought to you by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services and the Ad Council.
In a recent survey, investors shared what they felt were the greatest threats to their retirement. It's no surprise the most common threats include stock market volatility, economic uncertainty, conflict in the Middle East. Unfortunately, there are many threats beyond your control that can affect your retirement savings. At Goldco, a leader in precious metals, the team believes one way to protect your investment portfolio is with physical gold and silver. Goldco will send you a free 1 ounce silver American Eagle coin, and all you have to do is pay for shipping and handling. No obligation, 100% free. Call 855-971-2006 to get your free silver American Eagle coin.
In today's highly regulated climate, customized HR solutions are needed more than ever. Career Management Associates can partner with your existing HR department for projects or even serve as your outsourced HR team. From compliance and compensation to investigations and employee relations, CMA provides you trusted HR solutions. Call 207-780-1125 or visit cmacareer.com.
And we're back, and you're listening to the HR Power Hour presented by CMAcareer.com and Verrill-Law.com. I'm your host, Tani Alvarez, and today our guest is Rob Brooks, attorney and labor and employment law partner at Verrill. And today we're discussing the Great Resignation and restrictive covenants. Specifically, we've been talking about steps your company can take to protect competitive data at a time when employees are transitioning in and out of companies regularly. Prior to the break, we are talking about confidentiality provisions, also known as non-disclosure clauses or NDAs. All have that same effect, just under or using different names. Earlier, Rob, you had mentioned that there's multitude of different ways or different types of agreements that fall within a restrictive covenant and what that term encompasses. And you mentioned non-solicitation agreements. What is a non-solicitation agreement?
Well, a non-solicitation agreement essentially just means the employee agrees not to ask certain groups of people or businesses for some sort of business. And also in other situations, not to ask certain employees to leave their employment to go work for them. So we have non-solicitation of customers, typically, and non-solicitation of employees. So those are the two categories of non-solicitation agreements that we typically deal with.
It's interesting because you and I look at a lot of handbooks, for a lot of different types of entities. And we may have listeners, I think, right now are saying, yep, we have non-solicitation in our handbook. I think it's important that listeners be mindful that this is a different type of non-solicitation generally than what we see in most handbooks. In most handbooks, we see language that says employees cannot do multi-level marketing or attempt to sell Girl Scout cookies to employees at work unless it is during very distinct timelines. What we're talking about here, however, even though it has a very similar meaning, Rob, is different, correct?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, we're not, as you pointed out, we're not talking about whether you can sell Girl Scout cookies at the office for your child or babysitting services, or you are soliciting people to buy some sort of product that you're selling as a side gig. We're talking about what an employee can do typically after they leave your employment and go work somewhere else. Can they solicit your customers? Can they solicit vendors? Can they contact them? Can they solicit your coworkers? Again, can they strip you of your staff? And so it's very unlikely that your handbook would address those fact patterns. And if you have a business interest in preserving your relationship with customers, clients, as well as your existing employees, then it's important to have in writing an agreement with your employees that they won't solicit customers, clients, employees for some period of time after they leave.
This is really helpful because honestly, I always question a company that restricts the selling of Girl Scout cookies on site because it's restricting my ability to access kind of those amazing little boxes. But let's kind of divide this up a little bit further. So you mentioned soliciting employees. Can you have a rule in place, or can you require an employee to sign an agreement that says, after I leave this company, I will never contact current employees of the company in the future? Can you require that they cut off all contact to their former coworkers?
Sure. Good question. You know, how far can an employer go in terms of restricting their former employees' activities? And when it comes to soliciting their former coworkers, there are limits. Essentially, the standard applied by courts in terms of whether these agreements are enforceable is whether they are designed to protect legitimate business interest. And so, you know, what's the legitimate business interest in preventing a former employee from communicating with or soliciting their former coworkers? And the legitimate business interest in that case would be that employers have a right to expect some amount of loyalty from their employees while they're working for them. And there's a certain goodwill between the employees and their current employer. And employers have a right to try to protect that. But, you know, how far can they go? Can they prohibit the former employee from making a direct solicitation to the employees? Hey, I want you to leave with me and I want you to come and I want to start a competing business so we can go really take business away from our former company. That's probably enforceable, at least for some reasonable period of time. But can you prevent an employee from actually communicating with a former coworker? Like, don't even call them. I think it would be a rare circumstance where a court would look at that restriction that's so broad and say that they're protecting a legitimate business interest as opposed to overreaching and getting into somebody's personal life. So again, employers can write these contracts and agreements as broadly as they want, but as we'll discuss later, it gets tricky when it comes to enforcing.
So let's jump to clients and customers. So you mentioned that you can also have non-solicitation agreements for clients and customers. Now, is this only current clients and customers? Can you include former clients and customers, potential clients and customers? The whole world, if you wanted to.
Sure. Well, that's a great question. Again, this and then this issue of what's enforceable is important to keep in mind. And repeating the standard for solicitation of employees, namely, is there a legitimate business interest to be protected? That applies also to clients and customers. So does an employer have a legitimate business interest in protecting a relationship with its current clients and customers for some period of time? And the answer is almost always yes. There's certainly goodwill that's can be protected by these agreements. So what about former clients and customers? The answer is a little less clear, but if it's a recent customer or client, let's say within the last 12 months that you've done business with this customer or client, then most courts, I think, would say that's reasonable. Is it a client, or what about a client or customer that you had 5 years ago? Well, probably less compelling a case to be made that there's legitimate business interest. Conversely, what about prospective clients? How far into the future? You know, if you've got a hot lead and you're negotiating with a particular prospective customer, then that interest is probably protectable. But what about just a hypothetical lead, somebody in a broad industry class then that you're interested in pursuing? That's probably less likely to be something that an employer can try to prevent an employee from soliciting.
For those of you who are just joining us, you're listening to the HR Power Radio Show. I'm your host, Tani Alvarez, and today our guest is Rob Brooks, attorney and labor and employment law partner at Verrill. And today we're discussing the Great Resignation and restrictive covenants. Rob, I'd like to switch gears a little and talk about non-compete agreements, which I think is something that is at the top of a lot of people's minds as to, well, isn't the best thing for me to do is to enter into non-compete agreements with all of my employees so that they can't go and work for a competitor after they leave me, with the counter argument being, hold up a second, you can't restrict my ability to make a living. Talk to me a little bit about what a non-compete agreement looks like and what some of the biggest issues that should be at top of mind for employers are.
Sure. Well, a non-competition agreement, as the name implies, prohibits employees from competing with their former employer. And this competition can take the form of the employee working for another company that competes with the employer, or starting their own company that would compete with the employer either in whole or even a small part of the business. They don't have to be an equivalent business. They can just be competing even in just a small market segment that the former employer engages in. So the non-competition agreement is like the non-solicitation agreement and confidentiality agreements. Has to be designed to protect a legitimate business interest. And as you pointed out, there are some real public policy concerns raised by trying to prevent someone from earning a living. And for that reason, most courts will look very carefully at any agreement that says an employee can't work in a particular field or for a particular type of business. And they'll look pretty hard and scrutinize any legitimate business interest that is asserted by that employer.
So when we're looking at those business interests, I mean, you've talked about courts a number of times. And after the next break, I do want to get into a much lengthier discussion about what the litigation process looks like. But one of the things I always think about when we say a court is what court? Jurisdictionally, how does this work? Does it go to the court where the employer is located? Is it the court where the company is incorporated? Is it where the employee works, especially at a time in which we're seeing a lot of remote workers? When we're creating these agreements, what law applies? And can I just choose the least restrictive law, the one that's most friendly to my organization, and just kind of stick that in the agreement?
Yeah, well, you certainly put your finger on one of the most difficult issues with respect to non-competition agreements and their enforceability, namely, where is the worker living? Where is the worker doing the work? Where is the employer located? And the answers to these questions can have a really significant impact on whether that agreement is enforceable, because the various states, many states indeed have taken a position as to what's a legitimate business interest. So in some states like California, for instance, the legislature decided that non-competition agreements are just against public policy, except in a very few limited circumstances. And so they're unlawful in states like California. But in states, in other states, many states, I'd say the majority, there's no express statement by the legislature that non-competitions are unlawful. Again, the courts are just left to figure out what's a reasonable business restriction. And then there are a bunch of states like Massachusetts, Maine, New Hampshire, that have gotten in Illinois too, that have all just sort of taken a middle ground. They'll say that you can have a non-competition agreement, but it's only applicable to certain types of employees. You know, people who earn a certain amount of money, X number of times the state minimum wage, for instance. Other states will also say that there's a timing requirement. You know, Pennsylvania, for instance, Maine, Massachusetts, New Hampshire, but you have to present the non-competition at the beginning of the employment or a certain amount of time before the agreement takes effect in order for it to be enforceable. You also have to, in some states, have to pay extra money, extra consideration over and above just continued employment. So these are all questions that are important to answer when you're drafting these agreements. And also when you're deciding whether and how to enforce them.
So what it comes down to is, from a lawyer standpoint, it depends. There's lots of elements here. And for our listeners who have heard me speak in the past, they're saying, yep, that sounds just like Tawny. But let me give you a hypothetical, because you know how much I love hypotheticals, Rob. So I own a pizza and sub restaurant, in Massachusetts, let's say. Massachusetts, I own a pizza and sub restaurant. Can I require the sandwich artist at my restaurant to sign a non-compete that says that they will not compete, they will not go and work for Jimmy John's or Subway for 2 months after they leave my organization? What are your thoughts as to whether or not that's going to be enforceable under Massachusetts law?
Yeah. Well, Massachusetts, again, is one of those states that has decided to legislate what these non-competition agreements can look like. They haven't banned them outright, but they've certainly entered the field with some requirements. So in terms of your hypothetical, let's just start is there a legitimate business interest in preventing a sandwich artist or... we'll use that name, sandwich artist at Jimmy John's, we're going to work for, say, Subway. I suppose if there's some trade secret or other business secret, some special sauce or secret sauce, as you will, that Jimmy John's wants to prevent from being abused, on that would arguably fall within a confidentiality agreement. And I think an employer could say, hey, the secret sauce that we use here in our at Jimmy John's, and you can't use that anywhere else. That arguably could be enforceable, but can you prevent that employee from actually working and going down the street to make sandwiches? Boy, that'd be a hard thing to enforce, I would think, because in that instance, Jimmy John's would really be trying to assert or protect a monopoly on employment and the employees, and trying to secure a monopoly is not a legitimate business interest. But to your point, in Massachusetts, there's one other thing that's worth keeping in mind. In Massachusetts, actually, for an enforceable non-competition agreement, you have to have some sort of agreement with the employee that you're going to pay them some extra money. And in some circumstances, that could be paying the employee not to work. So essentially paying some amount of money to the employee while this non-competition period is running. So if it's a 2-month non-competition period, then you've got to pay them some amount of money for those 2 months, whether it's 50% of their pay or some other amount of money.
That is very helpful. Thank you. Thank you for that. We're going to take a quick break. You're listening to the HR Power Hour on News Talk WLOB 100.5 FM and WLOBradio.com. We'll be right back.
In today's highly regulated climate, customized HR solutions are needed more than ever. Career Management Associates can partner with your existing HR department for projects or even serve as your outsourced HR team. From compliance and compensation to investigations and employer relations, CMA provides you trusted HR solutions. Call 207-780-1125 or visit cmacareer.com.
If a natural disaster comes knocking, how prepared is your family? You can't just close the door on earthquakes, floods, or hurricanes and hope they go away. That's why it's important to make a plan now. Ready.gov/plan has the tools and tips you need to prepare your family for an emergency. So if disaster shows up at your doorstep, you'll be ready. Visit ready.gov/plan and make a plan today. Brought to you by FEMA and the Ad Council.
At over 150 years old, Verrill has an illustrious history with more than seven generations of legal expertise. With more than 130 attorneys across seven offices from Maine to Washington, D.C., Verrill serves clients across the country and around the world. HR professionals, business leaders, and in-house counsel count on Verrill as one of the premier labor and employment law practices in the Northeast. Contact Verrill at verrill-law.com. That's verrill-law.com.
And we're back, and you're listening to the HR Power Hour presented by CMAcareer.com and verrill-law.com. I'm your host, Tani Alvarez, and today our guest is Rob Brooks, labor and employment attorney and partner at Verrill. And today we're discussing the great resignation and restrictive covenants, how we can protect confidential information from falling into the hands of competitors. Before the break, we were talking about the use of non-compete agreements and how they interrelate with non-solicitation agreements. And then confidentiality or NDAs or non-disclosures, lots of agreements with different names that really protect all of the same information, really helping your entity maintain confidential and proprietary data and information. So, you know, Rob, we focused a lot on proactively kind of creating or making sure these protections are in place, but we haven't talked about what would happen when an employee leaves employment and potentially does breach one of these agreements. So what happens then? Is it just that we send a nasty gram? Do we sue them and take their house and car, or what does that look like?
Sure. So, you know, as you've said repeatedly throughout our chat today, that we seem to be in the middle of a great resignation. People have been leaving their jobs at a much higher rate in the last year or so than in prior periods of time for a variety of reasons, some of which seem to be related to the pandemic. And, you know, with this increased resignation rate seems to be occurring a rise in people leaving, not just to switch careers, but to pursue their prior career, but in a different setting. And what's happened, and what we're seeing, at least in our cases, is a real spike in people leaving their employer and taking with them the confidential information that they had with their prior employer, whether it's a customer list, other confidential customer information, documents, business plans, strategies. Again, companies are looking for workers, and the value that a new employee can bring to the new employer can often be affected by how much information they're bringing with them from their prior employer. And so this is clearly is a concern to most employers, again, who are trying to protect their business information. And so when we get into litigation, you know, what happens typically is, you know, we get a phone call, says, you know, Rob, Tani, you know, I had this employee who worked for me for 10 years. They were really important. And, you know, they quit last week. They didn't tell me where they were going, what they were doing. They were really tight-lipped. And I just saw that they're now with my big competitor. They're soliciting our existing clients. We've already lost three customers. I want to sue them. I want to shut them down. and then we ask them, okay, well, do they have, you know, we start go through the list of questions, like, do they have a non-competition agreement? Do you have a non-solicitation agreement? Do you have, you know, an NDA? Tell us what you got. So the first thing we ask is, show us your documents, show us your policies. Do you have policies that protect your trade secrets? And so once we go through that list of options, namely, we're looking for ammunition. What can we use to go to court to make a convincing argument that we have legitimate business interests to protect and that employee is violating either their agreement or either their statutory obligations? Because it's worth keeping in mind that even if you don't have a written agreement, that pretty much every state has a law that serves as a kind of NDA, a confidentiality agreement. It's called the Uniform Trade Secrets Act. And so if you have information that meets the definition of a trade secret, namely some sort of information that has value by virtue of being secret, and the employer takes reasonable steps to keep that information secret, such as having employees sign agreements, or even just having a policy. Again, we talked about policies at the beginning. So again, the employer should have a policy in their handbook that says employees will be exposed to confidential information and trade secrets of the employer, and they're expected to keep that information secret for as long as that information is confidential. And that means even after the employment ends. So that's the first step, is we look and see what we've got for ammunition. And then we talk to the employer about, okay, what do you want to achieve here? You know, usually telling that we can't likely convince, keep someone from working and earning a living, but where do we want to end up? And how do we want to get there? And then we have a bunch of options that we can discuss. And the first thing, as you said, Tani, is the nasty gram. This is usually the least expensive and most efficient way to communicate to the employee that you're unhappy. It often has a relatively high degree of success in stopping any improper conduct. And what's a nasty gram? Well, it's a letter, whether it's from the employer or from their attorney. Who sends the letter? It's up to the employer. And sometimes people respond more to a lawyer's letter than the former employer's letter. And the letter basically says, we understand you're competing or you're using our secret information or whatever it is they're doing that's inappropriate. We want you to cease and desist from this improper conduct immediately. And if you don't, then we'll take certain steps, typically threatening litigation. And in the context of that letter, it's quite common for us to also include some language that says, and by the way, we want you to either destroy whatever information that you've got that belongs to us, or maybe in the alternative, if you think you're going to sue them, we want you to preserve any and all documents or other information that you have that relates to whatever your conduct has been the last, whatever it is, however long it's been since they've left, such as communications with your new employer, with anybody who may have received our information and the like. We call that a litigation hold. And if the employees fail to comply with that litigation hold, that could be really held against them by a court down the road if they've destroyed evidence. And so there are certain consequences, bad consequences, that can befall the employee if they destroy documents after getting that litigation hold message. So that's the first step.
So I think it's important to note too here that the first step includes, not just a discussion concerning the fact that we have this agreement, the agreement's been signed, but after someone signs an agreement, the organization still has to take steps to protect the confidentiality of data and information. The document itself isn't going to provide you with all the protections necessary if you are waiving, if you're waiving confidential information out the window for everyone to see. Rob, in cases like this, who are the parties? Are we suing, is the organization suing the former employee, or could the organization sue the new employer as well?
Great question. Generally speaking, the defendant, the person who's being sued, is the former employee and not the new employer. The former employee is the one who, in most instances, has signed some sort of agreement with the employer, like an NDA or a non-competition agreement. And so the claim that would be made by the former employer is basically one for breach of contract. We had a contract, you signed it, you promised not to do this, you broke your promise, we're suing you for that. That's the basic claim for most of these cases. And the new employer would not have signed an agreement with the former employer. So there's no breach of contract claim. there are occasionally claims that we can make against the new employers, like one would be a tortious interference with your contractual relationships with your employees. So if there's some unlawful scheme to poach your workforce, that you know, it's essentially is an unfair competition by your competitor by just saying, well, they're not going to build their business the old fashioned way by going out and pounding the pavement for new customers. They're just going to essentially steal your employees with higher pay or benefits or whatever. But that behavior is generally allowed in our capitalist society. And unless there's some sort of fraud or intimidation or a scheme to essentially steal your confidential information that you can prove that the new employer is engaged in, then you're not likely to have a claim against them. Which isn't to say that you can't drag them into the litigation, you know. And so if you sue your former employee for breaching an agreement, you can generally go take depositions on the new employer's employees. You can demand that the new employer produce documents with, you know, using a subpoena, and then you drag them in, and you know, essentially have a three-way fight, even if that new employer is not officially a party.
That's really helpful to understand. We're at a point where we need to take a break, unfortunately, but you're listening to the HR Power Hour on News Talk WLOB 100.5 FM and WLOBradio.com. We'll be right back.
In today's highly regulated climate, customized HR solutions are needed more than ever. Career Management Associates can partner with your existing HR department for projects or even serve as your outsourced HR team. From compliance and compensation to investigations and employee relations, CMA provides you trusted HR solutions. Call 207-780-1125 or visit cmacareer.com.
Founded in 1958, Jackson Lewis is a national law firm with a local presence. The firm's 765 attorneys practicing in 54 locations throughout the U.S. and Puerto Rico provide a wide range of resources to address every aspect of the employer-employee relationship. HR professionals, business and in-house counsels, and C-suite professionals count on Jackson Lewis as it has one of the most active employee litigation practices in the United States. Contact them today at jacksonlewis.com. That's JacksonLewis.com.
And we're back, and you're listening to the HR Power Hour presented by CMAcareer.com and Verrill-Law.com. I'm your host, Tawny Alvarez, and today our guest is attorney Rob Rooks, partner at Verrill in the Labor and Employment Department. And today we're discussing the Great Resignation and restrictive covenants. We've had a great conversation about what restrictive covenants are. We've talked about NDAs, or otherwise known as confidentiality or non-disclosure agreements. We have talked about non-solicitation agreements. We've spent some time talking about non-competes. Prior to the break, Rob, you were sharing information about what litigation looks like. What would happen if a former employee were found to have breached terms that had been entered into during their former employment, whether sharing of confidential information, competing and sharing data and information? Let's talk about why, though, or the remedies. So if you're an employer who has lost an employee to a competitor, what are your potential remedies that you can receive if you were to attempt to litigate a situation such as this?
The remedies vary depending on what claim you are asserting. So, for instance, if you have a contract with the employee, and contract would include a non-disclosure agreement or non-competition agreement, those contracts will often spell out what you can get from the employee if you prevail in the litigation. And one of the most important things for employers in these kinds of cases is to try to get what's called injunctive relief. What's injunctive relief? Well, that's an order from the court that tells the employee to stop doing something. So this kind of relief can be hard to get. Again, usually courts just award money damages. But if you can get an injunction from the court that says, I, the court, am ordering you, former employee, to either stop working for that new employer or to stop using the former employer's confidential information or to stop soliciting those customers. That's a very powerful thing, because if the employee refuses to comply, then that employee is in contempt of court. And if they don't purge their contempt by complying, the remedy is they can go to jail, which is a very powerful, although oft very rarely used remedy, but at least it's a possible outcome for an employee who refuses to comply with a court order. So that's the first thing that we try to get in these kinds of cases. And if we can get that early on, then that gives the employer tremendous amount of leverage, because there is a way to convince a court to issue what's called either a temporary restraining order or a preliminary injunction, so that the court protects or preserves the status quo between the parties by saying, hey, you employee, stop doing what you're doing, at least while we litigate the case. And so courts generally don't like to order any kind of relief before the case is ultimately decided. But since litigation takes 1 or 2 years in many instances to complete, we do have this temporary remedy. And if the employer can get that temporary remedy, the preliminary injunction, for instance, then they have a tremendous amount of leverage. And most often these cases will typically settle with some sort of negotiated resolution. It could be the employee pays the employers, well, agrees not to work for that company or agrees to keep their hands off of certain customers. So that's the most important and primary piece of a remedy or kind of remedy that we want to get. Second is money damages. You know, if you've lost customers and business, you can recover money from that employee if you can, as long as you can prove it. And if you have a steady stream of income from certain customers and you've lost them, then that calculation is something that can be done. And then the third kind of main remedy is the recovery of attorney fees. And in the contracts that many employers have, NDAs, non-solicitation agreements, non-competition agreements, then the employer can recover their attorney fees. This is, of course, subject to some states that do limit the ability to recover attorney fees. And to the extent you have an attorney fee provision, some states require that provision be reciprocal. Namely, if the employer sues the employee and loses, doesn't convince the court to issue an injunction or to grant money damages, and the employer has to pay the employee's attorney fees. But other states will allow a one-way attorney fee provision where the employer is the only party that could get their fees. So those are the three major types of remedies: injunctions, money damages, and attorney fees. And in our experience, the last one, the threat of having to pay the employer's attorney fees, can be the tail that wags the dog in a lot of these cases. And drives early settlement.
Rob, thank you so much for all of your time today. I think that this has given listeners a really good general understanding of information they can protect, how they should go about protecting it, and then what litigation looks like if those agreements were ever breached. So thank you so much for your time and for being a guest again on the show. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
You've been listening to the HR Power Hour on News Talk WLOB 100.5 FM and WLOBradio.com. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week.
Thank you, everyone, for listening, and catch us every week at 10 a.m. on News Talk WLOB 100.5 FM or 1310 a.m. and streaming live at WLOBradio.com. Podcasts of this show and every show are available at hrpowerhour.com. Have a great week, everyone, and remember, HR management is critical to your business's success.